guys. Welcome to Spotlight on Maryland. It's Gina Crash, your host for the next half hour or so. Really excited to introduce you to our two in-studio guests this morning. First up, the return of President and CEO of the Esophageal Cancer Action Network, Mindy Mintz-Mordecai. Mindy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, we're so excited. And we're in the middle of, well, actually on the heels of, I should say, Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month, which was the month of April. But honestly, every day, that's really important. And we'll talk about some things.
We always say every month is Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month at ECAN.
That's exactly right. And you've brought along Kim Wilson with you, who is an advocate and esophageal cancer survivor as well. Right, Kim?
Yes, I am a stage 4 esophageal cancer survivor.
That's amazing. And a huge advocate for ECAN. So you might hear us refer to the Esophageal Cancer Action Network as ECAN or esophageal cancer as EC, just to, you know, shorten things up. And I have a little intro here we're going to read just for people to be enlightened here. One American dies of esophageal cancer every 36 minutes. And most people with the disease don't know they have it until it's too late. We're here to learn more about the disease, who it affects, and how it can be prevented by talking with Mindy Mintz-Mordecai, who started the national nonprofit ECAN, Esophageal Cancer Action Network, after losing her husband to the disease, and Kim Wilson, an esophageal cancer survivor who advocates for ECAN. So again, welcome to you both. And Mindy, a great way to start is the way that you started, a national nonprofit organization to educate others about esophageal cancer. And why is this cause so important to you? We heard a little bit about it in the intro, but this is definitely very close to home for you.
Very close to home. 17 years ago, I lost my husband to esophageal cancer. At the time, our kids were 9 and 12. And besides the overwhelming grief that we experienced, I was really angry. I was angry because during the course of my husband's treatment, I learned that the disease that was going to kill him was caused by reflux disease, something that we all think of as benign. And I felt like a fraud had been perpetrated on my family, that nobody told us that reflux could kill you, or even what the symptoms of reflux are. Everybody thinks it's just heartburn, but really there are whole lot of symptoms that all of us experience, and we don't realize that the source of those symptoms is reflux. And so I couldn't sleep at night after losing my husband and going through this tragedy for our family. I thought, how many other families are going to go through this before somebody decides that it's important to let people know that reflux disease can cause cancer?
Yeah, and thank you. First of all, very sorry for your loss, and thank you for, you know, taking that grief and helping others with that, and making sure that maybe someone doesn't have to go through what you've gone through with you and your children. And about how many people have esophageal cancer in the U.S.?
So living with esophageal cancer in the U.S. today, we think it may be around 50,000. Every year, about more than 20,000 people will be diagnosed with esophageal cancer, and every year more than 16,000 will die. So esophageal cancer is really pretty rare. It's 1% of all cancer diagnoses in the country. However, it's the cause of 2.6% of the cancer deaths every year in this country. So when you think about that impact, you know that this is a deadly cancer that we are not doing enough about, people don't know enough about. And the thing that's most aggravating to me is it is preventable. And that's why we started ECAN, and that's why I'm here today talking to you. It's why we started Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month. We want people to understand that they can take action and save their own lives, but they have to be informed and they have to be willing to take that next step and find out if they're at risk.
Yeah, and how did you accomplish that in Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month last month? Like, what are some of the key components, and how long have you been doing that?
You know, so we started Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month in 2009. So it's been a while.
Yeah.
16 years we've been doing this. And every year we add a little bit more. You know, we've been sending out kits to people with awareness information, brochures and posters they can post in their own communities. This year we kind of put on a little extra oomph to our efforts, and we have a video billboard in Times Square. We did that last year as well.
That's huge.
Last year we only were able to afford to run it for 1 week. This year it's the whole month of April. And we've been doing a lot of efforts to reach out to the media, like you folks, to get the word out to people so that they understand not just the facts, because I think the most important piece about telling this story isn't the numbers, it's the people.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's so important we have Kim here today.
Yes, yes. And we're definitely going to delve into her story. And what else is unique about your organization is that you are national. If people go on your website, which is ecan.org, you'll see that you have board members and advisors from all over the country.
Right.
When you were founding this, Why was that so important to you to be, and how difficult is it if you're talking to someone who's going to start a nonprofit to become a national nonprofit? Because you are locally based as well.
Right.
But
we started in Baltimore. Yeah. And, you know, we didn't know when we first started what we could do. I just knew that we had to do something.
Yeah.
And we had a really fantastic local board of support. But what we realized is after doing a few really exciting events, you guys were supporters of our Cancer Dancer galas that we did every year. And
yes.
They were a lot of fun. But I realized that, you know, I didn't give up my career to host events. I wanted to save people's lives. And while we might get the word out to people in the Baltimore area, that wasn't sufficient to me. And so we moved our scope to become more national. And, you know, it changes the tenor of your organization.
Yeah, it
does.
Because
the kind of organization you can have when everybody gets to meet face to face is different than the kind of organization you can have when you have to do it via Zoom.
Right, right.
It's a lot harder via Zoom, I can tell you.
It is.
But you get the opportunity, as you say, to bring in people who have expertise and knowledge and who care about this, who are all over the country.
Yeah, it's really important. And who is esophageal cancer affecting generally?
So, you know, here's the thing that is also a bit of an annoyance to me, because, look, the doctors, they have to do this. They have to say, here are the people most at risk. And the people, quote unquote, most at risk, it's going to be men. Men are four times more likely to have this disease than women are. But we're sitting here with Kim.
Right, exactly.
And it's all usually people over 50. And yet what we've seen in recent decades is younger people, we've seen a tripling of this diagnosis among younger people. The saddest story I know is of a 16-year-old boy diagnosed with stage 4 esophageal cancer. And it took a long time for them to figure out what was wrong with him, because they just assumed that couldn't happen to a kid that age.
Yeah.
And we're seeing more and more young people diagnosed with this disease. And the saddest part is that they're usually diagnosed at later stages and have worse outcomes. And so when you say who's most at risk, I don't like to do that, because it, even, you know, it used to be old white, fat white guys. That's who people would talk about. But,
right.
You know, we did an interview with some D.C. media, and I brought one of our supporters who's an African-American young woman who lost her father. And so it's not just white people. It's everybody could be at risk. And, you know, the one thing we know is that reflux can lead to cancer. I'm going to tell you there are people who will develop this disease who never experienced a symptom of reflux. About 40% of people may have reflux and not know it. It can be silent. They may not feel any symptoms. But the most common type of esophageal cancer in this country is definitely caused by reflux disease.
And what are some of the symptoms and the cause, which we kind of touched on a little bit, but since it's hard to sort of say exactly who it's affecting, maybe if people can recognize those symptoms as a means of trying to, you know, protect yourself.
So, you know, first of all, persistent heartburn, that's pretty easy to think about. But the thing that, and I'm going to go through a couple other symptoms of reflux I want people to be aware of, it's a persistent cough, a persistent sore throat, a persistent hoarse voice. You might even see your tooth enamel wearing away. You might not know you have reflux, but you see your tooth enamel going away. That could be a sign that you have reflux disease. And if you have these symptoms and then they go away all of a sudden and you have no idea why, some people get a false sense of security from that.
Yeah.
And actually what that means is likely that you're more at risk, because there is a precursor condition before esophageal cancer develops called Barrett's esophagus. And Barrett's esophagus causes that lining of your esophagus to start to change and look more like the lining of your stomach. And when that cellular change starts, that's when we get that opportunity for cancer to develop. But also, you no longer feel those symptoms anymore, because your stomach's used to dealing with all the junk that's normally in it.
Mm-hmm.
And when the lining of your esophagus starts to look like that lining of your stomach, you're not feeling it anymore. And some people feel relief, but really that could be your sign to definitely don't walk, run to your doctor and say, I think I need to get checked.
Yeah. So how can people determine if they're at risk for the disease?
So first of all those symptoms are things to, if they're persistent, I'm not talking about if you get, and we have seen situations where people had only occasional heartburn and then developed the disease, but generally it's a persistent case of reflux disease. If you have a family history of Barrett's esophagus or esophageal cancer, you are definitely at higher risk. There is research now that has proven that this can run in families. Again, men are more likely, men who are older, especially if you're overweight and you carry your weight around your midsection. That is also a risk factor. If you smoke, that can cause you to have reflux.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the smoke itself is what's causing it. It's the smoke causes that lower esophageal sphincter to loosen. Also, if you have a hiatal hernia, you are more likely to have reflux disease.
Wow, that's important. Thank you, Mindy, for pointing that out for us, too. And are there any new tests available besides endoscopy, which people have probably heard of?
Right. So endoscopy is a sedated procedure. There are now new tests. One particular test that's available in the market, and we expect many more to become available soon, that can test your esophagus, take some tissue from the esophagus, do a DNA test to discover if you're at risk, and it's minimally invasive. You do not have to be sedated. And the most exciting news we've had in the last month or so is that some insurance companies are now starting to cover it.
Yay!
So for us, exactly, that to me is, you know, I made a joke when we first posted about it. I said, you know, this could be one small step for this company, but one great step for people at risk for esophageal cancer. Because if we can do, you know, when you're talking about a rare cancer, you can't look at the dollars and cents of it and say, let's do an upper endoscopy for every single person who has heartburn. It just isn't cost effective, and
right.
It isn't without risk.
Yeah.
You know, ask Joan Rivers.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned that you posted about it. You guys are really active on social media. What platforms would you say you lead people to the most? And obviously, ecan.org, your website, is very important as well.
We have a really strong Facebook community, and we're growing in our Instagram. We have a lot of really good LinkedIn supporters, and we've started to show some growth in Threads as well.
Oh, great.
And we are on X, but not quite as much.
Right, and a little bit of YouTube as well.
Yes,
sometimes.
We definitely have a YouTube channel. We also have a Vimeo channel.
Awesome. So you really are getting the word out there, you know, as in any way possible. And what are the survival rates with early detection looking like, for a little bit of hope here?
Yeah, I wish it was more hopeful. Even detected at stage one, the survival rate is less than 50%.
Wow.
And so that's why our mission is to get people to find out that they have Barrett's. Because if you have Barrett's, you can get Barrett's treated, eliminated, and eliminate your risk for esophageal cancer. And, you know, look, most people who have reflux disease are not going to get cancer, thank goodness. But if you're one of the unlucky ones, you probably won't discover it until that day, like my husband, you couldn't swallow your food. And by then, we don't have really good tools to fight that disease once it's that advanced. So what we're trying to encourage people to do is get checked. You know, do reach out and see if you're able to get access to these minimally invasive tests. The test that's on the market now is called EsoGuard, and you can go to EsoGuard.com and find out how you can get an EsoGuard test. There's also tests that can tell you if you have Barrett's esophagus, whether you're likely to progress to cancer. There's a TissueCypher test that you can find out about at TissueCypher.com, where they can tell patients who have the not most threatening, I guess is the best way to say, form of Barrett's, whether they're at risk for progression. Because if you've got this disease, it could develop, you're 25 times more likely to get esophageal cancer if you have Barrett's. So I can understand if you have Barrett's, you're worried. Here's a test that can tell you, you can sleep at night because we can project that for the next 5 years, you're not likely to develop it. Or we can tell you that you're at higher risk and you need to get checked more often.
That's very helpful. And would you say that's your most important mission, ECAN's mission? Do you have like a blanket statement, or do we really just cover that, which is just to make sure people are aware?
Well, no, one of the things that, you know, we started out, our goal was that awareness message.
Mm-hmm.
And what we realized was you couldn't just go around telling people that heartburn can cause cancer and then everyone's going to get saved, because that isn't what happens. Not everyone can get an upper endoscopy. At the time we started, there were not these minimally invasive tests. So that's a huge development for us. But we also realized that esophageal cancer was one of the least funded in terms of research funding. And so we began a campaign to increase research funding for esophageal cancer. And over the last 4 years, we've increased the federal budget for esophageal cancer research by more than $20 million.
That's fantastic.
And that's part of the work that Kim's been doing, advocacy on the Hill, trying to make sure that our legislators are making sure that money's available. And in a day like this, you know, in a world where research funding is being cut, this is something that we're really, really focused on. We also want to make sure that patients have good education. So it isn't just making people aware. It's for patients who have already been diagnosed. We want them to know, here are the best treatments, therapies. This is what the research is showing, because it's constantly evolving. And it's an exciting time, because we've had new therapies approved for our patients. And, you know, one of the things that I guess we're most proud of is that when we first started ECAN, the National Cancer Institute was just starting something they called the Cancer Genome Atlas, where they were mapping the genomes of different cancers, and we were not on the list. At the time, esophageal cancer was the fastest increasing cancer in the country. Today, it's the fastest increasing cancer for American men. But at the time, that was for all Americans. And I went down to NCI. I said, how can we not be on your list? They said, oh, well, it's really hard to get the tissue samples. And so I went to the doctors on my board. I said, can we get the tissue samples?
Yeah.
We went back and said, we'll get you the tissue samples. They said, oh, well, we don't have the money. And at that point, you know, I was working for free. We had $40,000 in the bank. And my board chair was looking at me like, we're not doing this. And I said, well, wait, how much do you need?
Yeah.
And they said, we need $500,000 to get it started. And look, $500,000 for a little organization that has $40,000 is a lot of money. But in the scheme of the world, I thought, that is not a lot of money, and we can find that money. I said, if we raise it, will you put us on the list? So we sent a letter to the head of NCI and said, if you'll put us on the list, we'll get that $500,000.
Wow. And NCI is the National Cancer Institute?
Yes.
Wow. So, Mindy, see, you are ferocious, I'm telling you.
Well, but look, yeah, you have to give a lot of credit to my board because
yes,
they were willing to stake themselves on it.
Yeah.
But here's what happened. 6 weeks later, I got a call from one of the researchers who was on the inside of that what they call the TCGA. And he said, you're going to get a call inviting you to work on the Esophageal Cancer Pilot Project Disease Working Group. And I said, what? He said, yeah. I said, they're doing it? And he said, yeah. And I said, when do we have to start raising the money? And he said, I don't think you do. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I think you shamed them into finding it in their own budget.
Oh, that's incredible, Mindy.
And I said, I don't care how we get there, as long as we're there. Here's why this matters. You know, at the time we thought, you know, this was the train leaving the station. They're going to do map the genomes of cancers, and we aren't going to be part of it. Once again, esophageal cancer left in the dust.
Yep.
They included us, and what we discovered, you know, back in 2017, they published the report, and what they found was that the type of esophageal cancer that's most prevalent in this country is very similar to the most prevalent type of gastric cancer.
Mm.
And so our patients then started to be included in all these clinical trials they were doing in gastric cancer, because that's a much more prevalent form of cancer. So our patients were included in that research, and that the result was in 2021, the first immunotherapies for our patients were approved because they discovered that for esophageal cancer patients, these drugs that were also helping gastric cancer patients were going to be effective.
That makes a lot of sense. And you guys, we've been listening to Mindy Mintz-Mordecai, President and CEO of ECAN, the Esophageal Cancer Action Network. And we want to bring back in to the conversation Kim Wilson, an advocate, stage four esophageal cancer survivor, and big, huge advocate for ECAN. And Kim, we're so excited to talk to you and hear your story. And why was it important for you to get involved with ECAN?
Education and awareness really drove my desire to work with ECAN. Unfortunately, my esophageal cancer diagnosis resulted in me having to end a 22-year career in public education. So education's always been at my core. And this was just a different way, once I was strong enough from treatment, and to be able to give back and educate in a different way.
Yeah. And tell us, what were your symptoms and how did you come to be diagnosed with esophageal cancer?
I was diagnosed in the spring of 2022. In winter of 2022, I started having difficulty swallowing. I started noticing an increase in hiccups to the point where it was impacting my ability to even have conversations. I would take a casual sip of water or coffee in a meeting throughout the workday, and then I would develop and experience hiccups that would impact my ability to proceed with conversations. And I also, while eating even small amounts of food, noticed an increase in burping or belching that just was not normal and really didn't sit right with me. My difficulty with swallowing was what really sounded the alarms. And what was unfortunate is I learned later that that difficulty is swallowing is usually when patients, the cancer has progressed to the point of stage three or stage four. And in my case, it was stage four by the time it was detected. So I was having difficulty swallowing pizza crust, sandwiches, steaks. Just always felt like something was getting stuck.
And Kim had just gotten married.
Oh, my gosh,
I had.
Wow.
It was actually just 4 days after our wedding when I was driving to work that I was eating a bagel just very casually and on my way to work in the car, and I actually choked on the bagel. And that's when I called my husband, and he's like, okay, you know, we thought it was the stress of the wedding planning maybe prior to that. So that's when I had to take a little bit more action.
Wow, he sounds like a great partner too. Tell us a little bit about your journey with the disease. You go from that experience, which then was like, oh, wait, I've got to figure out what this is. And then what's the next step after that?
So after seeing my primary care doctor, who referred me to a gastroenterologist as well as a referral for endoscopy, that endoscopy was completed in early April of 2022. As soon as I woke up from that endoscopy, the doctor came in and talked to my husband and I and let us know that he had found a significant tumor. It was not a solid tumor. It had already flowered, if you will. Mm-hmm. So that was a sign that it had gone through several walls. He said he biopsied it and we would just have to wait back to receive those results. Very fortunately, I actually got those results back in less than 24 hours, which is unheard of in a lot of ways. Due to some complications from the biopsying, I did end up back in the ER the next day, but was released later that evening and started immediately getting calls from my care coordination team. And that was directly from my doctors. They recognized how serious this was. Less than a day after being diagnosed, I sat down with my surgical thoracic surgeon, oncologist, and then my radiological oncologist to develop our plan of action.
So what was that? What did that treatment plan look like for you at that stage?
At that point, after having some lymph nodes removed that were outside of my lung, I underwent chemo and radiation. That was over a course of 6 weeks. And then
take all the time you need, honestly.
After 6 weeks, I then recovered for a bit of time. We noticed that I had a tremendous response to treatment. I underwent a Mechoian esophagectomy, which was a 12.5-hour surgery. I then spent 12 days in the hospital in ICU.
Can I just jump in?
Of course,
Minnie. Esophagectomy, what they mean is they're taking out her esophagus, they're pulling up her stomach and reattaching it.
Wow.
So she can no longer lay flat or else she's going to aspirate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very life-changing experience.
Absolutely. So, how has esophageal cancer, good point, Mindy, changed your lifestyle, Kim, after the surgery?
Well, unfortunately, after the surgery, I did have a reoccurrence about 3 months later. So I underwent 2 years of immunotherapy and chemo. I actually wore a pump home. I would be in the clinic for 6 hours on a Monday, and then I would wear a pump home for 2 more days. So I did that every other week for 2 years and completed that this past November. So overall lifestyle changes, that was a huge lifestyle change. My life went on and off for 2 weeks cycle. Extreme fatigue. Like Mandy said, I have to sleep inclined for the rest of my life because of aspiration risks. I can no longer eat more than about a cup of food at a time, so many more frequent meals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dealing with issues with blood sugar, complications with having gastric surgery. So it has impacted various parts of my life, but I do consider myself a thriver because I'm still living my life.
Absolutely. Yeah, and telling the story and helping others, which is so, so important. And so what message do you want others to know about esophageal cancer and particularly ECAN, which I know that was really important for you to get involved to help others?
I want everyone to know to just advocate for your health in general. But when it relates to EC specifically, just know that symptoms progress quickly. So stay on top of your routine appointments. Advocate. If something doesn't seem right, go to your doctor, advocate for that endoscopy. Sometimes doctors are still reluctant to complete endoscopies. They just say, you have some GERD, you have some reflux, let's try some medications. But it's important that if you sense that something more might be going on, just advocate for yourself and the tests that are needed for a peace of mind or, I hope not, but for a diagnosis so that you can get earlier treatment.
Yeah, time is really of the essence, because when you found out you were stage four, so, you know, and everything kind of accelerated, your treatment plan and everything accelerated quickly. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to make people aware that esophageal cancer is not a cancer that every institution is familiar with. So the studies are very clear that your result after an esophagectomy is going to be much better if you go to a surgeon who's performed many esophagectomies. And that may seem like common sense, but a lot of folks think if you go to the doctor down the street, you're going to get the best care. And you could hope for that, except that this is a rare cancer. And that's why we spend so much energy on trying to educate patients so that they know what questions to ask, what to look for, what therapies are available. One of the things we see often is that patients who are in treatment can't swallow. And sometimes they will, because as Kim talked about, the tumor is blocking your esophagus, they often will put a stent in. Stents can cause a lot of issues. Some people do very well, but some people do not. There are now procedures where they can use cryotherapy to freeze dry, essentially, that tumor and make it smaller so that people can swallow. But the reality is that many oncologists aren't familiar with it and they're not using it. And so we're trying to make sure patients know that there are other alternatives out there, and we provide a lot of information on our website.
I bet a lot of people want to take you along with them to their appointments, Mindy, because, and Kim as well, because you two are you doing the best you can. And Kim, real quick, how are you supporting ECAN to get the word out about EC? Because you mentioned you had to sort of your career had to be put on hold for this, you know, for fighting the disease and for your survival. I mean, you had to focus on your health, as you're telling others to do.
Absolutely. But as I became stronger and the support of my husband and my family, we have been able to host two successful annual Paint the Town Periwinkle fundraiser events for ECAN. My husband and I are 2025 Steps to Save Life co-chairs for ECAN's 5K. We've spent time on Capitol Hill advocating for research funding. I was fortunate enough to speak at an FDA hearing back in September regarding my response to therapy and advocating for others to have therapies available to them. I had the governor of Maryland declare April Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month this year. And I work with industry, medical industry, on their patient panels, and then any way that I can in the community, local events, baseball games, Bay Sox games, throwing out first pitches, having awareness tables, and just making sure people have information.
Kim's an amazing advocate. I can tell you, I've been with her on Capitol Hill, and she brings tears to people's eyes when she talks about her experience.
I can definitely see that. Thank you both. Kim Wilson, who was just speaking before, stage four esophageal cancer survivor and advocate for ECAN. Thank you, Kim, for all you're doing, for sharing your story. And you know, we welcome you back in the future. When is that, the 5K that you were talking about?
The 5K actually happens annually in April.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay,
every
so
April.
Perfect. So we're right up. Perfect
it just
timing.
Ended.
We just, yeah, exactly. It's here. We are in very early May. And Mindy, gosh, we can't thank you enough. Mindy Mintz-Mordecai, President and CEO of ECAN, the Esophageal Cancer Action Network. Thank you for all you do, not only during Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month, but every day to advocate for people with the disease, and like your late husband. And how is your family doing?
They're great. I've got two adult children who are very resilient and are doing very well in their lives, and I'm very proud of them.
That's the best news that we've heard. And you guys, thank you both so much. We welcome you back in the future, because as you say, Mindy, you know, the therapies and everything and the information is ever-changing. So, you know, we could have you back next week and you might have something new to report.
I hope so. We're looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And we encourage people to go to your website, ecan.org, and to check you out on all the social media platforms, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn, X, Threads. What else do we forget? Vimeo
and YouTube.
YouTube. Perfect, you guys. Thank you so much for listening to this production of Odyssey Baltimore.